In Lounge Croon, the eighth part in the history of popular music in Britain and America, Kenneth Moore traces the last days before the great stock market crash of 1929. It was a time when Cole Porter conquered Broadway, when the public first became aware of a new phenomenon, the crooner, and the Paul Whiteman Orchestra featured an obscure singer, Harry Lillis Bing Crosby.
If you remember, last week, we left the story of popular music poised at the point in time when one great vocal idol was about to be superseded by another. And the significant thing is that both these men were boosted by scientific inventions. Both immensely talented, certainly, but both tremendously helped by the power of electricity. In 1928, Hal Jolson, rising on the tidal wave of talking pictures, made a movie in which the human voice was heard. Soon, Paul Whiteman's band was seen and heard playing on the screen, complete with a vocal trio sounding like this.
When the sun goes down, the tide goes out, the darkies gather round and they all begin to shout. Hey, hey, Uncle Dud, it's a treat to beat your feet on the Mississippi Mud. It's a treat to beat your feet on the Mississippi Mud. Oh, what a dance do they do. Lordy, how I'm telling you, they don't need no bands. Take your time by clapping their hands. Just as happy as a cow chewing on the cud when the darkies beat the feet on the Mississippi Mud. Lordy, how they play it. Boy, they really sway it. Say, that music thrills me. Boy, it nearly kills me. When the sun goes down, the tide goes out, the darkies gather round and they all begin to shout. Hey, hey, Uncle Dud, it's a treat to beat your feet on the Mississippi Mud. It's a treat to beat your feet on the Mississippi Mud. Oh, what a dance do they do. Lordy, how I'm telling you, they don't need no man. They keep time by clapping their hands. Just as happy as a cow chewing on the cud when the darkies beat the feet on the Mississippi Mud.
Mississippi Mutt, and the group singing it, the Rhythm Boys. There were three of them, Al Rinker, Harry Barris, and Harry Lillis Crosby, soon to be world famous as Bing, and already well aware of how Jolson had been delivering the goods.
I'd heard all his records, of course, and I knew about his vocal abilities, but his chief attribute was the center of an electricity he generated when he sang. He moved in a way that these imitators can do, you know, people that give impressions of him now can do, but nobody in those days did just that. When he came out and started to sing, he just elevated the audience immediately. On the first eight bars, he had them in the palm of his hand. He had a great face. Of course, he mostly worked in blackface in those days. He had great drive. Inexhaustible energy. I remember when he played Spokane, he was all over the theater and checking the box office and the receipts and still singing the lead and ordering everybody about. He took full charge, you know. But I guess he got a piece of the gross, you know, a percentage, and he just wanted to see how he was doing. I don't know. I'm sure it didn't affect his performance because he had only one speed, and that's full bore when he went on stage, no matter what he was doing. But I never intentionally imitated him. But I'm sure I did involuntarily just slip into certain things that he did, and I imagine I still do use some of them.
I'll get by as long as I have you, though there be rain and darkness too. I'll not complain, I'll laugh it through. Poverty may come to me, that's true, but what can I say? I'll get by as long as I have you.
Now, the moment you hear that voice, you know that something drastic is happening to popular singing. It's not just that it's less fresh than Jolson, more subtle, if you like. What's really significant is that there's been a new invention to make that kind of singing commercially exploitable. That invention was electrical recording. and the improvement of the microphone that came with it. And the effect this had was to make possible a singing style with the one quality that Jolson lacked, and indeed probably wouldn't have wanted. That quality was intimacy. And if Bing's kid brother Bob doesn't actually use the word intimacy, he uses another one that in this context means the same thing, natural.
I think, first of all, to be an innovator or to be a musician of any creativity, you have to have ears. And do you know what I mean by ears? You have to be able to hear the sound, recognize it, know what to do with it, and do it correctly. And I think Bing has a great ear for music. He certainly had no vocal training, which also could have tended to lead him into the almost crooning, talk, sing type of style. But I think it came natural to him. I think he was a natural singer. I think the placement of his voice was naturally placed. There was no attempt. He never thought of himself as a great singer. Never has, and I still think today he doesn't consider anything but what happened to him as being lucky. I think it was probably the naturalness. He did his thing, and he did it differently than anyone else.
We're very lucky to have great songs, and that's the key to any singer's success. If he's got material and can use it with reasonable competence, why, he's halfway home, you know.
I could show the world how to smile. I could be glad all of the while. I could change the gray clouds to blue if I had you. I could leave the old days behind, leave all my past, I'd never mind. I could start my life all anew if I had you. I could climb the snow-capped mountains, sail the mighty ocean wide. I could cross the burning desert if I had you by my side. I could be a king, dear, uncrowned, humble or poor, rich or renowned. There's just nothing I couldn't do if I had you.
Crosby recording was made in January 1929, and it, and lots of others like it, helped Crosby to outdistance the field in the new race that the public came to regard as the great crooner handicap. Crooning became the great sensation and, of course, also the great joke of the age. Just as today we laugh at the expense of long hair and 5-ton amplifiers, so in the late 20s people laughed at the idea of a crooner. They laughed because they felt there was something a bit girlish about the idea of a grown man speaking tender words of love at them. They'd been raised on the Jolsons of this world, throwing themselves all over the stage and shouting at the tops of their voices. Now, suddenly, the men were singing tenderly. Perhaps Crosby's greatest rival among this new breed of honey-voiced warblers was the king of the college campus, Rudy Valley. But Valley had been linked with history not through the microphone, but with something very different. A giant megaphone that covered half his face, which probably was an advantage so far as some of the singing stars of the period were concerned. In fact, Crosby never really regarded Rudy Valley as a rival at all.
He had the megaphone first, without the microphone. That megaphone that he sang through. He came out of Yale University and he had that Ivy League sort of a flair, you know, and sang the Main Stein song and college songs and Ba 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 and those kind of things. And then he had the Vagabond, I'm Just a Vagabond Lover, and Goodnight Sweetheart, and he had an appeal that was all his own.
For some girls are quickly forgotten and gone with the dawn of the day. Some you remember like
to last glowing embers, haunting your memory and dreams. For I'm just a vagabond lover, in search of a sweetheart, it seems. And I know that someday I'll discover her, the girl of my vagabond dreams.
One interesting thing about crooners like Valley is that the more calculated control of their voices tended to make them more stylized artists. And it's probably no coincidence that most of the outstanding singers in this style became accomplished actors or light comedians. Not only Valley and Crosby, but later warblers like Sinatra, Como, and Dean Martin. There was something about the crooner, perhaps, that made him a more of a polished performer than the all-out singers of the Jolson School. But Valley remembers the crooner of this new type almost totally forgotten today, but who seems to have started the whole thing.
I was really not the original crooner. I think there were other persons, like Vonda Leith was a very heavy gal who was singing in radio before I came along. And although Gene Austin was not per se a crooner, he did sing in a natural voice, more on the tenor type. And Gene was selling millions of records in 1925. See, I took a year out of Yale to play at the Savoy Hotel in London. And I came back after 9.5 months at the Savoy, sailed in the fall of 24 in September, and came back in June 25, and we entered Yale in the fall of 25. And when I got home, my sister, we were out on the back porch, which was closed in, and my sister Kathleen said, there's a singer that's very popular in Victor Records, and she had a little phone, we had a little phonograph there, and she put on one of Gene Austin's records, and I had never heard him sing before, and she said he's very, very popular, and at that time he was probably selling 2 or 3 million copies of every record he made, like Ramona, My Blue Heaven, and all the rest.
When whippoorwills call and evening is nigh, I hurry to my blue heaven. I turn to the right, a little white light will lead you to my blue heaven. You'll see a smiling face, a fireplace, a cozy room, a little nest that's nestled where the roses bloom. Just Molly and me, and baby makes three. We're happy in my blue heaven.
Gene Austin, Rudy Valley, Bing Crosby. The line of succession is firmly established. But for the moment, this is still early 1929, and Crosby, although easily the best singer around, is still only a member of the Paul Whiteman Band, with his boom years still to come. But before we leave the embryo Crosby, Let's take a look at a particular Whiteman recording for two reasons. First reason, the song in question was achieved by a non-professional. The lyric was written by a Wall Street banker called James Warburg, who wrote songs in his spare time. And soon, bankers were to have a great deal of spare time indeed. Which brings us to the second of the two interesting things about this next recording, the day it was made, September 27th, 1929, on the very eve of the greatest economic catastrophe of modern history. The song was called Can't We Be Friends?
I took each word she said as gospel truth, the way a silly little child would. I can't excuse it on the grounds of youth. I was no baby in the wild wood. She didn't mean it. I should have seen it. Now it's too late. I thought I'd found the girl of my dreams. Now it seems this is how the story ends. She's gonna turn me down and say, can't we be friends? Oh, I thought for once it couldn't go wrong. Not for long, I can see the way this ends. She's gonna turn me down and say, can't we be friends? Oh, never again. True with love, true with them. They play their game without shame. And who's to blame? But just the same. I thought I'd found someone I could trust. What a bust. This is how the story ends. She's gonna turn me down and say, can't we be friends?
Crosby's Can't We Be Friends, almost the last crooning noises anyone made before the great divide of the Wall Street crash came along and tempted so many tycoons to take long walks along short piers. Looking back on those last days before the jazz age suddenly buckled up like an old tin can, we catch a few glimpses of what some of the key musical figures were up to. For instance, the jazz trumpeter Charlie Teagarden, younger brother of trombonist Jack Teagarden, although still only a teenager, was already a professional.
I had left home in the summer of 1929 with a band from the University of Oklahoma. That particular university at that time was very music conscious. They had a big music program, and there were four big dance orchestras composed of students on that campus. We worked in Kansas City, and we worked in Chicago, and we worked in Ohio, different ballers and whatnot. We finally wound up in Pittsburgh, working in a place called the Fort Pitt Hotel. And at that time, Benny Pollock had just lost Jimmy McPartland and Benny Goodman. And Jack had told Benny Pollock, after McPartland left, that he knew that I was out playing with a band, and although he hadn't heard me play in a couple of years, that he would be glad to take a trip out to Pittsburgh to see me and hear me play and see if I would fit in that band. So Jack came out, and we had a little session together with the band and whatnot, and Jack said, oh, you'll do fine, you know, because I had memorized all the records they'd ever made up to that point. I knew everything Jimmy McPartland had played, or on record anyway, and so I left the next day, went to New York and joined the band there. Matty Matlock was in Pittsburgh with another band at the same time, and Jack hired Matty to come with me and take Benny Goodman's place, so Matty and I actually went to New York together, and this was in September of 1929.
The Ben Pollock Band, remembered mainly today not for the presence in the ranks of young Charlie Teagarden, but because of the clarinet player, another teenager destined to open yet another whole new age in popular music, His name, Benny Goodman. And soon, quite suddenly, we'll find him playing a major role in our melodrama. Meanwhile, the career of the Gershwin brothers was proceeding very much according to plan, although even they encountered an unpredictable problem every now and again. In 1928, the two brothers had written a show called Funny Face for Fred and Adele Astaire. And lyricist Ira Gershwin remembers the truth of the old statement that you can't please all of the people all of the time.
When we did Funny Face and opened in Philadelphia, one of the town's top critics stopped to ask me how the changes in the show were coming along. He then wondered if I had done anything about Swonderful. Swonderful, Smarvelous, You Should Care for Me, and so forth. And the middle part, you've made my life so glamorous, you can't blame me for feeling amorous, oh, it's wonderful, so on. And he said, well, what have you done about that song? I said, what about what I should have done about that song? He said, well, it contains an obscene phrase. I said, what's obscene about it? He said, you can't use the word amorous.
Don't mind telling you, in my humble sash, that you thrill me through with a tender cash. When you say you can't manage my emotion, I swore that and there, heaven is devotion. You made all other boys seem blind. Just you alone fill me with
Adele Astaire. Well, it's wonderful that a song like that should have been considered even faintly indecent, even in 1928. But that sort of thing never deterred men like the Gershwin brothers, and a year later, in the long, hot summer of 1929, a new Gershwin show opened at the Ziegfeld Theatre with really the most breathtaking range of talent. It was called Showgirl, and was predictably a backstage musical. On the first night, July 2nd, 1929, the leading lady, about to go into the show's big number, was suddenly surprised to find that a member of the audience had jumped up and was singing the song even better than she could. Which isn't very surprising when you realize the leading lady was Ruby Keeler, and the man who jumped up from the audience was her husband, Hal Jolson, and the song, George and Ira Gershwin's Liza.
Liza. Just smile on me, all the clouds are all away. Liza, Liza, don't let delay. Come keep me company, and the clouds are all away. See, the honeymoon I'm shining down. Oh, baby, I just made a date with Parson Brown. So Liza, Liza, name of the day. When you belong to me, then the clouds will roll away. With a parson's crown. Oh,
Liza comes from the Broadway flop, Showgirl, one of the very few Gershwin shows to lose money, and also one of the few Gershwin shows to include songs by other writers. This was because the part of the backstage baggage man was played by somebody who brought his own extraordinary repertoire of songs with him wherever he went. And sometimes he brought his own extraordinary repertoire of partners, too. Presenting those kings of vaudeville, Clayton Jackson and Jimmy Schnozzle Durante.
Say, Jimmy. Jimmy, you look worried. There's something on your mind. I wonder what it is.
Say, I just had an argument with Ziegfeld.
Ziegfeld?
Corner Broadway and 43rd.
Some corner?
You know, Ziegfeld said, do you know who I am? I said, do you know who I am?
What happened?
He said, who I am?
Yes.
I said nothing. I was cornered.
Cornered?
But it makes no difference what I start out to say.
Why not, Jim?
Why, this is what I wish to convey.
What is it, Jimmy?
Now, you know darn well I can do it out Broadway.
What?
But can Broadway do it out me?
No.
Why, Herald Square, Times Square, Columbus Circle, 96th. Say, where am I? I must have passed my station.
Why, he's lost.
They must have found out at Times Square that I passed my destination.
Why?
They sent messengers all over to get me to head a celebration.
I get it.
You know, as I got off the express, some yokel pushes me into a local.
What happened?
The crowd, seeing a mistake, pulled the emergency brake and shouted,
why, there's Jimmy that well-dressed man.
So you know darn well I can do without Broadway. What can Broadway do without me?
No, no.
Hey, can Broadway do without me?
The great, great Jimmy Durante, Schnozzola. The man who took on show business and won by a nose. But the oddest thing of all about Showgirl was the presence in the cast of a musician so gifted that not even George Gershwin could have considered himself in a different league. Showgirl saw the Broadway debut of the Duke Ellington Band, and the Duke recalls what it was like selling his own music.
The first day I started writing was a wonderful day. I never forget, Joe Trent and I were peddling songs around Broadway, and, you know, you go to the publishers, and they'd hear a song, and say, we don't need anything today. And so one day we went to Fred Fisher's, and he says, I like that. He says, Joe says, well, do you want it? He says, yes. He says, well, we got to have a deposit. We want $50 a piece. He says, sure, give me a lead sheet. So Joe looks at me and says, give the man a lead sheet. You know? And, you know, the man was going to close his place at 5 o'clock, and I think it was 4:30 then. And if we wanted this 50 a piece, why, Ellington had to learn to write pretty fast. But I made it.
Duke Ellington Band, who in 1929 appeared in a Gershwin show. No record remains of what the Ellington Band did in that show, but what has survived is a very curious fragment indeed. A few moments snatched out of oblivion, presumably because, unknown to the people involved, someone in the theatre had some recording equipment. The scene is a rehearsal for a Gershwin musical, and George, a shade self-consciously, which suggests he did, after all, know what was going on, pretends to reprimand a pair of comedians for being late.
Wait, wait, wait.
Let's
get going here. Let's get some work done.
Say, where have you been? You boys are a half hour late.
George, I was never late in my life. They've had to hold the show several times, but I've never been late.
Now, you boys don't even know your lyrics to this show yet.
We know the lyrics all right, but they're too high. You see, I'm a bass singer. I sang bass for 10 years at the Metropolitan.
Opera House?
Museum. All my family are musicians.
Listen, you may come from a very musical family, but you still don't know the lyrics to this show.
I'd know the lyrics if you wrote some notes in there like you wrote in your Rhapsody in Blue.
Listen, you'll sing the Mademoiselle song that I wrote for you and like it.
I like all your songs. How are you going to argue with an impresario like that?
I left my Mademoiselle in blue for yellow, but what the hell? You do as well. I left my Mademoiselle in blue for yellow. The truth to tell, you're twice as well. I love the lips. Oh boy, what hits when I observe, it's something curved. Then I declare, yes, I will swear, I'm glad I'm here over there. Oh, maybe if you could learn to play mama, to this papa, then what the hell? I'll never go back again to do.
A rare glimpse of George Gershwin during a rehearsal. Now, what else was the world singing in 1929? Well, very often, of course, songs that had been written earlier in the decade, but were proving to be durable enough to hint at their eventual status, which was to become popular classics. And you never knew just where such songs might come from. There was the bandleader Isham Jones, for instance, who in the mid-1920s suddenly turned on a burst of hit songwriting that stopped as suddenly as it started, but kept him in royalties for the rest of his life. One of the distinguished professionals who worked as an orchestrator in his early days was Gordon Jenkins.
He made money every direction he could. He was a wonderful writer. He had big hits. Swinging Down the Lane, Had to Be You, One I Love, Belongs to Somebody Else, Spain, On the Alamo. Big songs. Big, great giant songs. He was a strange man. I liked him very much. He wasn't very popular with the musicians because he was very gruff and hard-boiled and everybody had to walk up on a stand in a line like prisoners and go off the same way. And you weren't allowed to drink even when you weren't working, even on your off days. He just raised an awful fuss if he caught you drinking. And so it had a whole band of alcoholics. Everybody just went the other way and drank themselves stupid. But he was a good musician in what he did. He couldn't conduct. He never did master the few little things he had to do to follow singers or change tempos. He was a one-tempo man. But he was unbeatable when he got in his tempo. He'd make a band sound better than anybody. The only leader around that time, everybody else waved and smiled at the girls and hoped to God they'd all finish together. But Jones really, really did it. He'd sit there and talk to you at a dinner table while the band is playing and make an arrangement, make his own orchestration. While he's carrying on the conversation and while the band is playing. There weren't a lot of fellows around who could do that.
It had to be you. It had to be you. I wandered around and finally found the somebody who could make me be true, could make me be blue, and even be glad. Just to be sad, thinking of you. Some others I've seen might never be mean, might never be cross, or try to be boss, but they wouldn't do. For nobody else gave me a thrill. With all your faults, I love you still. It had to be you, wonderful you. It had to be you, no one else would do. You thrill me, so it had to be you.
The Isham Jones Orchestra playing one of the leader's most successful songs, and incidentally the vocalist's name, Kurt Massey, echoes of Crosby, Another highly successful writer of hits, Richard Whiting, kept his name in circulation very much longer, partly because it was carried on by his singing daughter, Margaret Whiting. And she reveals that in the case of some of her father's hits, for instance, "She Is Funny That Way," her old man wrote more than just music.
Well, he wrote two or three lyrics. I didn't take credit for them, but he did write the lyrics to that song. I don't know that much about it, except that they'd tell me he wrote it for my mother. Now, my mother would not live in a tent, even though that's what the lyric says. But very good lyric. Well, I do many of my father's songs. And I'll say, people ask me, do you write the music or the lyrics? And I'll say he writes the music to everything. But this was one that showed the other side of the coin, that he could do both. That's why he was a good all-around songwriter. We say a great American songwriter.
No, I ain't much to look at. I ain't nothing to see. I'm just glad I'm living, and I'm lucky to be. But I got a woman that's crazy for me. She's funny that way. I can't save a dollar. I ain't got a cent. But she wouldn't holler no. She'd live in a tent. I mean, this woman that's crazy for me, she's funny that way. And you know, she'd work for me. Oh, she'd slave for me night and day. Maybe she'd be better off if I just pack my grip and I make my getaway. Oh, but why should I leave her? Why should I go? She'd be unhappy without me, I know. I mean, this woman's crazy for me. She's funny that way. Coward at my best, and I'm almost certain that she'd follow me west. I mean, this woman is crazy for me. She's funny, very funny that way, yeah.
Is everybody happy? Ted Lewis, of course, and his band playing "She's Funny That Way." Words and music by Richard Whiting. Meanwhile, what about Great Britain? Where was her popular music coming from? One man, one of the very few, in fact, who eventually wrote songs in the American theatre tradition and matched the very best Americans, was Ray Noble. Although in 1929 he was occupied rather differently, working in a band for an organisation perhaps not unknown to listeners. Noble's rise began when he made a deal with veteran publisher Lawrence Wright.
He figured that with the rise of this dance band bit, he ought to have a dance band arranger, so he called me in. Of course, I was very amateur, but on the other hand, I was with other guys in the business, you know. So I learned from them, and I was also very keen and listened to every band that I could and so forth. And I got the general sort of drift of the thing, I think. And so I joined Laurie Wright as an arranger. And from there, I went to the BBC under Jack Payne, who had more or less just started there, as the arranger for the house band. And I was arranging for Jack Payne, and I was quite happy there. I was very fond of the corporation, but I thought it was an awful nice bunch of people then. Of course, we did have a lot of chaps who really should have still been in the army, but they were awfully nice fellows, even if they didn't know anything about broadcasting.
Too thin and not too fat. I like a little girl like that.
like the way she wears her hair. She's got that something for which I care, and this is what I'm getting at. I like a little girl like that. Ain't that a girl? By gee, by heck, I tell you, pal, with me she's check and double check. And someday soon, when I decide, I'm going to get me a nice young bride to share that cozy little flat. I'd like a little girl like that. Yes, I'd like a little girl like that.
Vocalizing with his own band, working for the BBC. Now, musicians like Ray Noble saw popular music from the vantage point of the dance hall, the recording or broadcasting studio, and the nightclub. The theatre world, then as now, was very far removed from their world. And to get a perspective on one very extraordinary musical star of the late 1920s, we have to turn to the Parisian impresario who gave her the chance to show her stuff. His name, André Charlot.
It is difficult to define what makes B so great. She is most attractive, yet she is not a beauty. She can put a song over better than anyone else, but is she a singer? As a burlesque dancer, she is simply supreme, but is she a dancer? The only category in which I can classify her is solely her own. It is the B Lily class, and there is no other member in it. It is made up of individuality, genius. Her satirical humor is devastating, but never better. And forgive me, B, you are a sublime superclown, which I mean as the greatest compliment I could pay you.
Well, André Charlot.